From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a question. What does racism mean for climate change and vice versa? The question was posed last year by Sarah Kaplan, a climate reporter for The Washington Post. In her piece titled Climate Change is Also a Racial Justice Problem, Kaplan cites data about the intersection of these two issues. She quotes Penn State meteorologist Gregory Jenkins, who noted that racism is inexorably linked to climate change because it dictates who benefits from activities that produce planet-warming gases and who suffers most from the consequences. According to data from the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences, Black and Hispanic communities and counties, countries that are mostly home to people of color, are most exposed to air pollution and are more likely to experience the economic harm caused by climate change. So what can be done in terms of climate action that will create equitable solutions for all communities? A new educational series is focusing on the injustice that is a cause and effect of climate change. Climate of Change, 22 Days of Learning and Action for Intersectional Climate Justice in Rochester and Beyond, will address how environmental injustice harms the region. It will also present ideas for how to create effective solutions that address these disparities. This hour, we preview the series and discuss the broader issues of climate justice with our guest. The executive director of the Climate Solutions Accelerator is Abby McHugh Griffa, who's back with us. Abby, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Daphne Rose Sanchez is executive director of Kinetic Communities Consulting. Daphne, thanks for making the time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Hello to Dr. Kian Yame, who is equity advocacy officer at the Urban League of Rochester. Kia, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Julio Jordan is Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Ibero-American Action League. Julio, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I'd like to ask all of you in a moment to give us a sense for what the term climate justice means to you and maybe how your view of it has changed or evolved with more understanding and more work in this area. Before we do that, though, let me just ask Abby McHugh Griffa to tell us a little bit about what is coming up with these 22 days of learning in action. Go ahead, Abby.
All right. So we have quite a program set up here, and this has been collaboratively organized by Urban League, Ibero, a number of other organizations. And we've put together this 22 days to really cover in a pretty holistic way this issue of climate justice. Where does it come from? So we're going to start by looking at the history of environmental racism in Rochester and beyond. And then what does that mean currently? You know, in terms of the issues that our community is facing today, how is that a product of that legacy of environmental racism in our community? And then what do we do going forward? So the final week will be focused on building skills, taking action, and, equipping people really with the knowledge and tools that they need to go out and start making some positive change in our community.
Who is this aimed at?
Everyone, really. Right now, I'd say our local climate movement is not as diverse as it should be, needs to be, would ideally be. And so in terms of involving just a broader cross-section of community members, that's definitely a priority. But, really, to take meaningful action on this issue, there is a role for everyone to play. And so anyone and everyone who doesn't feel like they have currently a firm grasp of what climate justice is, what it means for us locally, what you can do about it, that's our target audience.
Let me ask our guests here how they view the term climate justice and maybe how that view has come into focus over the years. Daphne Rose Sanchez, let me start with you on that.
Sure, thank you. For me, climate justice is really thinking about achieving equity in both social economic participation while remediating the same social economic and health burdens on communities that have been traditionally disinvested in. It's very important while I look at climate justice to not only think about how do we move forward in the clean energy transition, but how do we do so in a way that is restoring and acknowledging the disadvantage and the disinvestment that has been done in the past to BIPOC communities, so Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
Okay. Dr. Nyame, how do you see that term and what it means to you?
Well, as the advocacy and equity officer here at the Urban League, and interrupting racism, the initiatives that we have, I look at environmental justice as another inequality that is on the list of the many things that particularly people of color and indigenous peoples continue to suffer from even today, whether they live in a community that has been overwhelmed by chemicals coming from the local factory, or whether they are in flood lanes or whatever that may be that causes issues as far as being able to live a wholesome life.
Okay. Julio Jordan, how do you see it?
I look at it as, it's something that, first of all, I would start off by saying that this is a newer concept to me, but diversity, equity, and inclusion is something that I'm passionate about and have made it my professional career. And to truly understand the intersectionality between diversity, equity, and inclusion, one has to understand how climate justice and how these things also directly correlate with the inequalities that we face as a community. And none has ever been so in my face as the storms that we had in Puerto Rico that devastated Puerto Rico a few years ago with Hurricane Maria.
I'm glad you bring that up, Julio, because what I want to ask you all to kind of describe for our audience is, if there was an event or something that happened in your life that moved you into this kind of mentality, action, et cetera. I mean, I was thinking about generational divides on this. So I did not grow up learning about climate change in school. I was not really on the radar. My 9-year-old the other day, he had a birthday cupcake that someone got for him, and it was in a plastic container, probably a totally unnecessary plastic container. And he has been learning recently about the recycling numbering system. So he flipped it over and he saw that it was a number 6. And he said to me, he said, "Dad, this probably can't be recycled." And he said, "This cupcake did not need to be in this plastic." I didn't even know until recently, thanks to John Oliver's show, that on the numbering system for plastics, a lot of the higher numbers, even really 1 and 2 can probably be recycled, if I'm remembering correctly, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, often not. And just the fact that I'm learning about this now in my 40s, whereas my son is at least growing up with the mentality to look, to ask questions, to ask who, what's impacted, I think his generation is going to have a better chance to grow up, and it becomes part of their life from childhood, whereas a lot of us came to it in different ways. So, Julio, for you, was it the hurricane really that sort of sparked this for you personally?
Well, that Hurricane Katrina. And really, it came down to the dialogue that I was having with people where it was kind of like, well, why don't they just leave? Why don't they just seek refuge in higher ground or go relocate? And to understand that people in these communities that have been marginalized and disenfranchised don't have the capabilities of just picking up and moving. But it's also ironic that the areas that were most affected were the areas that were impoverished, specifically within the Black and brown community. So it's easier said than done when someone says, well, why can't you just, insurance will take care of that, or why can't you just get in your car and drive away, or why can't you just take a flight somewhere? Well, it's not that simple when systemically things have been, barriers have been put in place to prevent you from being able to have the economics and all of that. And one more thing, without taking too much time, I grew up in the South Bronx. It was always easier for me to find candy, high fructose juices, those things, but it wasn't easy to find fresh vegetables and things as simple as trees. So that has really, even when I was young, exposed me to it. But now, as I'm doing this work, it really makes me think, like, how do these intersect and how do they impact each other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I powerful stuff. Can I ask, I don't know if I hear Abby or Daphne?
Yeah, no, I was going to say that's exactly right. Like, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in Williamsburg, in an area that is now very populous because it's been gentrified. When I grew up in Williamsburg, it was pretty desolate. It was, predominantly Black and Latino communities, and we also had immigrant population, Polish immigrants and Italian immigrants. And there was so much disinvestment that there was a lot of buildings that were abandoned and a lot of buildings that were just not kind of up to par. And so for me, climate action and climate justice is not something that I had necessarily learned, but it was something that I had seen in my environment. I realized, you know, I grew up in public housing. My father's grew up in public housing. My grandmother's been in public housing. And so there was this association of the built environment and who we are. Like, oh, because you're, you know, a public housing resident, then you should be, enter whatever stereotype here. And my parents really fought very, very hard for me to grow up and not feel that association of your personality and who you will be in the future related to your built environment. And so they actually purchased a home. And then within the year of them purchasing the home, Hurricane Sandy happened. And myself and my parents, we were all in the home when that hurricane happened. And we waited on the roof for a whole bunch of hours to get rescued. And it was that moment when I was going to undergrad, and I was like, this is messed up. You know, how is it that my family lived in public housing? You know, it wasn't taking, the building wasn't taken care of. And then they buy a home and we lose it to Hurricane Sandy. So I did a little bit of research, and I realized that some of you may know, you know, the federal government created maps that basically stated, well, if you want to, as a bank, invest in a specific neighborhood, then you can. But if there are Black people, if there are Puerto Rican people, that's considered detrimental, and we won't recommend you to invest in those neighborhoods. And surprise, surprise, the area in Williamsburg that my parents are from and the area in Staten Island that they were able to purchase a home in were both in areas that were historically redlined in the past. And that was the moment to me when I realized the intersection of, you know, even if we're moving forward with, you know, a brighter future, we need to start correcting historically incorrect and historically racist practices with all of our policy and all of our programming, because if not, we're just going to continue perpetuating injustice for Black and Brown and Indigenous populations.
Daphne, given the story you're telling here, it lines up exactly with some of the stated objectives, for example, of a Green New Deal. And some of the criticism, even from, you know, sort of the political center, if that exists, I guess, is that, well, why are you putting economic policies in a Green New Deal? Why are you putting anything that's not specifically environmental in a Green New Deal? I know you've heard that. Do you feel like your own life experience gives you some answers to that?
Absolutely. I mean, the country has created racist economic policies that have inhibited Black and Brown people to own homes, have inhibited them to have careers, and inhibited them to have an opportunity for a basic education. And so we need to correct all of those wrongs. Right? We need to first, as a country, acknowledge that we've had racist practices, and it's only been done once through the, you know, it's done a couple of times, but never explicitly on the environmental side, because we have seen through the Community Reinvestment Act, which is a legislation where the federal government says, oh, we didn't realize we were creating racist maps. We're sorry. We'll, you know, start funding low-income communities. But those same maps are the ones, if you look at it and if you layer it on to fossil fuel industries, if you layer it on to pipelines, surprise, surprise, areas that have the highest environmental degradation are also areas that were traditionally redlined. And the environmental sector will never want to talk about their racist practices, because then that means acknowledging that they knew what they were doing was wrong and having to pay for that wrong.
Dr. Nyame, is there something that sort of moved you toward more interest and understanding of these issues?
It is. I mean, I do my work within social and cultural trauma and its impact on multi-generations of people, particularly Black people and people of color. And what I found from my own experience is that, you know, everything is correlated. As the other speakers had said, that the issues of environmental justice seem to be in the same places where other tentacles of racism is. right, in our communities. I remember after Katrina, I went down 2 years later for a conference and had made up my mind that when I go for that conference, I was going to rent a car and just go and look at the land and see what has happened. And needless to say that in that ward, I believe it was the 9th ward, there was no rebuilding. There was still home roofs on the ground and doors and smashed houses and, you know, abandoned cars and all types of things, you know. But yet, down closer to downtown where the convention was, it was all nice. New casino had just opened. It was clean, you know. And all these same disparities that we see in our communities all over the United States, particularly with that ideal of racism and what and how it impacts generations. So, yeah, personally, you know, suffer from sociocultural trauma, which you got me into it in the first place, because I always had questions when I was young. You know, I mean, how can these things possibly be right? How come I can't go over to Tommy's house? You know, how come I can't go to that school that's across town, you know, in the suburbs? You know, all those different questions. And then as I grew up and I became an individual that deals a lot with race and race issues and helping people to heal, I started to realize that everything is inclusive. You know, the environment, economics, you know, food deserts, you know, all of these things are part of that structural racism, as it were.
Well, Abby McHugh Griffa, you know, I know going back years, you have talked about the emotions for you, what kind of pushed you into this movement. But can you share again? I mean, really, and do you sort of share my feeling that there may be a generational divide that that for adults who have not really kind of grabbed onto this, sometimes it takes a 22-day learning series. Sometimes it takes an event in someone's life because we didn't necessarily have this kind of education and discourse when we were growing up.
Right. I definitely agree with that. You know, and for me, I came to this originally – you know, concern about climate, concern about the environment, certainly concern about what that meant for my children's future very specifically. And, you know, intergenerational justice is definitely an element of, you know, climate justice overall. So thinking about young people today, thinking about future generations, that, you know, that is definitely a vulnerable, very vulnerable population when we think about these issues. But, you know, for me as a middle-class white person, I was thinking of it more in terms of, you know, the how does this affect the land? How does this, you know, and it took me a little while longer, I'm embarrassed to say, to really think about what does this mean for people other than like, you know, my family, but to think of it more holistically about what does this mean for people around the world? What does this mean for other people in our community who maybe I don't have those kind of close, intimate, personal relationships with? And very specifically, what does this mean for people of color? It wasn't until I'd been doing this work for a couple of years that I really started to recognize and understand the intersectionality that, you know, everyone else has kind of spoken about. But now that I do get it, I probably heard my phone do that. You know, I recognize that we simply can't address these issues in silos. Climate change as an issue is deeply tied to housing, to transportation, to our food system, and to racism deep at the heart of all of it. So if we're not taking that holistic view and really understanding the history and the harm that has been done by policies like redlining, by urban renewal, you know, we just can't think about how to really kind of get ourselves out of this mess and get ourselves to a better place.
Yeah, and my feeling, and I wonder how our guests feel about this, when you think about the last year, the pandemic is in some ways a kind of analog to climate change in that, you know, we had this international emergency and we basically started telling people, well, you know, if you do the right thing, then this will work out. If you just stay home and wear a mask and stay 6 feet, this will work out. Well, who is that easy for? Who is it easy to deal with the condition of the pandemic? the people with the wealth and the resources. They have the space. They have everything that they need to, they could hire private tutors and teachers and do all kinds of things that people without means cannot do. And we, but we continue to hear the kind of rhetoric that says, hey, you know, do your part, which is important. I mean, we all have to do a part, but that's pretty much all we hear. We don't hear, well, why haven't we worried about resource allocation for people who literally can't, who don't have room, who live in multi-generational structure, you know, family structures, who if one person gets COVID, everyone's at risk. And that's sort of, to me, Abby, similar to the way we talk about climate, and that, well, if you just recycle that bottle stays out of the ocean, it stays out of a fish, and the fish stays out of you, and shouldn't you feel good about yourself? Now go drive your Prius and feel, you know, feel great. I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to be cynical, but I
think, you're absolutely right. I was going to say, you're absolutely right. There's a level of privilege in all of those items, right? Especially if it's not accessible to all. You know, the messaging and the marketing and the idealism of saving the planet for the future and saving the planet for the dolphins, when you have people being sick because there's mold and asbestos in their home, right? And you have people that are having to go out to work because they don't have the luxury to work from home. I think these are all really real things that people don't realize. Because of their comfort within their privilege, and without them acknowledging that privilege, then, you know, society will continue to operate and ignore that there are people that don't have those privileges. So,
yeah, and you know, I don't mean to rant. I just feel like, you know, it strikes me that plenty of corporations, I'm not trying to broad brush it, but would be thrilled. Many, you know, big businesses would be thrilled to make climate change a personal responsibility issue. Just be a better person and you can solve it. You know, be a good person and the pandemic will go away. As opposed to asking structurally, what did we do here? Who cannot deal with this? Who gets hurt the most by this? And yet we hear, you know, we hear the governor saying, you know, do the right thing. You know, if we do the right thing, we will beat this. Okay. I think that that's a convenient story that we tell ourselves sometimes. That's all I'm saying. But let me ask all four of our guests to answer an email that I think is, this is the kind of person who, you know, Abby and Dr. Nyame and Julio and Daphne, they're trying to reach with these 22 days. Michael says he's been an environmentalist since the first Earth Day in 1970. He says, became an environmentalist when I read Silent Spring. But how is saving the planet a racial issue? Either we save the planet or it becomes inhospitable for all 8 billion people. That's from Michael. Let me ask all four guests. I'll go right down the list. So, Daphne, I'll start with you. What would you say to Michael?
I mean, my honest answer is let it be inhospitable. If you can't support BIPOC communities through this transition, then you're saving the planet for yourself. That's my very, like, honest and aggressive response. But my, I would say, tamed down response would be the transition to help the planet will happen. We've seen historically transition, industrial revolution. We've seen the tech boom right now. But one thing that's been consistent time and time again, every time the market transforms, is that BIPOC community and other marginalized populations are left behind. I utilize the example of transportation very often with folks. When we talk about privilege, right, we talk about housing and we talk about education. We don't really think about transportation that much. This is an example, a live example that I know from New York. When a couple of years ago, there were multiple small businesses. They were immigrant-owned businesses, cooperatively-owned businesses, that would offer transportation services to seniors and other people in the community. What happened? A tech was introduced, and the tech says, you don't need to engage these small businesses anymore. Through your phone, you can receive transportation without talking to anyone. The idea for the market was great, right? It's a market transformation. There's convenience. People are very happy. So all seems ahead. People were moving forward, transforming the market, the transportation market. But what was something that people forgot? These cooperatively owned businesses, these immigrant-owned businesses that have traditionally provided transportation services to BIPOC communities, to seniors, and to other community members that were not served by kind of the luxury end market of transportation. So then what happened? Everyone uses tech now, right, to call for transportation, to call for a taxi. No one even remembers these small businesses anymore. Over 300 of these small immigrant-owned, cooperatively-owned businesses closed. It's pretty sad to see when you Google these small businesses online, a lot of them are extremely financial burden, and there's a huge amount of mental health issues. Folks have even taken their life because they cannot deal with the market transformation and how they've been left behind. So this is a very grim thing that's happened, right? And it's happening, and it continues to happen. Not only that, is that people that are using this technology today are not even seen as employees. They're seen as contractors. So we've made a market transformation for the convenience of all, but we have sacrificed workers' protections, we sacrifice small businesses, and we sacrifice immigrants. And it sounds so jarring, right, to hear, you know, tech that a lot of people use and see the dark side of it. And so I think we can move forward. I have no doubt in my mind that we will move forward with a solution for the environment. But I am heavily disturbed and very concerned about the pathway that we're moving forward in order to make it happen.
Okay. Julio Jordan, what would you say to Michael, who emailed and said, I've been an environmentalist since the first Earth Day in 1970, but I don't see what race has to do with it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? And I'll be honest, just like Daphne was, what comes to mind when I hear that is when somebody screams Black Lives Matter, this will be an individual that says, no, all lives matter. And the reality of it is that if all lives mattered, Black lives would matter too. So when we look at the environment and I look at, you know, I try to bring things from a personal perspective, not from a research perspective, not from a scholarly perspective, because living it is a lot different than studying it. So as someone who grew up in the South Bronx, at times I lived in the projects where there were thousands of families living together. And when I lived in smaller tenement buildings, there were, I would say, at least 60 families all lumped together. We used to have a program that was called the Fresh Air Fund, where they would bus kids from the city out into the suburbs and into the areas where there were trees, where there was nature, where there were streams and all of this. And it kind of, you know, makes you wonder, why do you have to have a program to bus people out of their communities so that they could take advantage of these resources that everyone else has advantage of or has advantage to? So you have to ask yourself, why is that? Another really a real in-your-face example for me is when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. You know, the work that I do with Ibero, we were actually the ones that received about 7,000 families that were displaced because of the hurricane. Those that were able to actually come and leave the disastrous areas where they were living were able to come to Rochester. Mind you, in the middle of winter, we don't need coats. We don't need winter boots and stuff like that in Puerto Rico. So they arrive here with nothing but T-shirts and shorts. So now if you look at the resources that have to be put together to get these individuals just to be warm, but then looking at the families that are here that don't have the room because they might only have a one-bedroom apartment and there's already three family members living there. Now, some people, for whatever reason, think that we choose to live that way, that we choose to have limited resources. Like, that's a choice, where in all reality, the reason why these things are present is because things have been designed in a way that is going to make it as such. There is no, I mean, when you think about it, and once again, I'll use me as an example. When I think about the fact that I can go to a corner store or maybe five corner stores within blocks of my neighborhood, and I can get for $2, I can get three bags of chips, I can get two containers of sugary juice, and I can get these things, but yet there's no way that I can get bananas, strawberries, or anything that's fresh or anything that is healthy. I won't be able to get that. There's a reason why that is in place. And if people don't realize that, and this is not just the South Bronx, Rochester, New York, Chicago. If you look at what happened with Flint and the water, this is going on for years, and it still hasn't been resolved, where just coincidentally, the people that were most affected by the lead in the water were individuals in Black and brown communities. It's crazy to think that, you know, environmental justice and the environment is, yeah, it impacts all of us and it affects all of us. But disproportionately, it is affecting marginalized communities. And once again, if you say, well, all lives matter, when I shout Black Lives Matter, then I have to honestly say you don't get it. And if you don't get it, it's hard for me to explain it to you until you actually live it. But I would challenge an individual to look at the privilege that they've had, whether their parents were able to provide that for them, whether their education was able to provide that for them, whether their circumstances or their neighborhoods or their surroundings were able to provide that for them, and then ask yourself, well, what has this done for me? And then look at an individual who did not have equal access to those resources and wonder, why are they in the positions that they are in? Yeah. Because there's a direct correlation between the two.
I'm going to have Kia and Abby jump in here. Let me just say that, you know, Michael followed up, and I just want to address one point here. Michael followed up to say, do your guests understand that inhospitable means incapable of supporting all human life? So he's saying climate change could eventually wipe out all human life. And all I would say to Michael, and I'm sure Kia and Abby can say it better than this, but Michael, you are correct that eventually this planet might not be capable of supporting life, and we will all be gone, and our descendants will all be gone, and that will be that. You're correct that that could happen. In between now and then is a long time. We will eventually be very uncomfortable. Then who is going to be able to handle everything between now and 8 billion people wiped out by climate change, Michael? The people with the money and the power and the resources. And right now in this country, who are we talking about? Michael, if you are only concerned with all lives being gone at the end of climate change, whenever that is, 100, 1,000, 10,000, a million years, then you are not concerned with who is being impacted by climate change now, next year, 10 years from now, 50 and 100 years from now. That's what we're talking about. That's not in the future. That's happening right now. Go ahead, Dr. Nyame.
Yes, yes, yes. I tend to mix research with personal experience. And, you know, Michael says that he's been an environmentalist since the 1970s. But then all of a sudden there was a need for environmental justice in 1991, particularly a declaration and principles of environmental justice that were created by Robert Bullard, to say, hey, we as people of color need to be included in what we call environmental justice, that all the changes to gentrification, urban renewals, you know, being put in floodgates and all of these different things, the redlining is part of our system and structure of way our country was built. Yes. We're also talking about, you know, he spoke about everyone perishing on the planet. But when we look at the planet itself, there have been several times that this planet has, what I would like to say, recreated or evolved. For example, there wasn't dinosaurs and man was not on the planet at the same time. You know, we see the Flintstones, or we see a caveman movie or something, you know, as growing up, and we would think that. But according to science, they're millions and millions of years apart, right? So here we are today, living this life today. Our average life may be somewhere between, say, 70 and 90 years old average. And we're still continuing to see the injustices being done in communities of color all over this country here. you know, and all, and in a lot of places around the planet. So looking at how it harms people of color is one of the fixes that we have to look into. I mean, because this is where it's happening. You know, I always tell my students, I'm saying, like, you know, we have a space station that we're building, right, as a country. And several countries involved, but, you know, we have a space station. Who's going to live there and why? You know, the poor people and people of color are not going there. You don't have $10 million for a ride. You know, so as I continue to look at the way things are happening and what's going on and the new things, why are we looking for another planet to live on? You know, why are we building a space station? And who is that for? So, okay, I guess the people that really matter are those who are affluent enough to not have to worry about it. You know, it's just really crazy. So with that piece, I know I said a lot. I just, you know, I'm into serving the people. And Carter G. Woodson said, you could not serve people by giving them orders as to what to do. The real servant of the people must live among them, think with them, feel for them, and die for them. Then we'll be moving towards justice. Until then, again, I agree with Julio. I agree with Abigail, all of them. You know, this person has got to be one of those all lives matter type of people because they haven't felt the impact. You know, they don't know. They need to come hang out. You know, let's bust some people into the city. I remember the Fresh Air group, you know, the suburban families hosting teenagers for a day or two or what have you. You know, well, come on into we're located on Clinton Avenue. Come on in and hang out on Clinton and take a look around and see for yourself how people are living by no fault of their own. Oh, they can get a job. They can pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Well, if you got to have boots to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. It's really, you know, I'm not going to go on a rant, but, you know, I mean, I even had to, you know, I wrote my book about the social and cultural trauma, you know, and I got a bone to pick with you, Evan, because I ain't heard an answer, but never mind that. You know, the reason being, because as a servant and as being able to live through all the, just say mess that I lived through, I realized that I wasn't the only one going through that. So let me dedicate my work into helping other people learn how to heal themselves, right? And that the first thing to learn how to heal yourself is your health. You know, these our communities, you know, are a greater risk of elevated temperatures and pollution, greater risk of disasters and illness, you know, greater risk for displacement, you know, and on and on and on and on. So when we can even that out and be everyone working for the cause of people, then we could take the race out of it.
Mm-hmm. I've got to let Abby jump in if you want. Abigail McHugh Griffith, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I have a couple things to maybe add. You know, one of which, and I think it was Dr. Nyame who kind of hinted at this a little, is that, you know, the planet will be fine. Whenever we talk about saving the planet, you know, the planet's not going anywhere anytime soon. It really is the people on the planet at the end of the day who, you know, that we need to be worried about. And specifically, you know, for someone maybe coming from this, from Michael's perspective, you know, there are already, you know, we talked about Hurricane Maria a little bit, Hurricane Katrina. There are also certainly whole countries that are becoming uninhabitable. And so where are those people going to go? So for the Michaels of the world who maybe are, you know, enjoy the way they are currently living in their current situation, you know, we need to be taking care of other people's homes in order to make sure that we don't have enormous, huge need for migration that's going to, you know, make resources scarce in our region and elsewhere. So, you know, if that's Michael's concern, then that might be something he wanted to think about. Also, just from a purely practical standpoint, given that a lot of emissions, you know, like think about here in the city of Rochester, I think it's about something in the neighborhood of 63% of housing units are rental properties. Not all of those are occupied by low-income residents, but many are. And if we're not thinking about how can we make sure that they enjoy the benefits of energy upgrades, then we simply can't reduce emissions enough to be saving the planet or saving whatever someone is most concerned about. So, you know, we need to have everyone participate in this transition and everyone be able to reduce their energy use, which is going to take significant investment and, again, make sure that no one's left behind. In addition, there is the fact that, you know, white people have created this problem. This is a problem that was primarily created by wealthier white people. White people still, you know, use more energy on average overall, given the, you know, larger houses, more travel, you know, more driving, more air travel. So, you know, to me, that does mean that we have a greater responsibility, again, for, you know, taking action in our own lives that will benefit others who, you know, we've created this problem for them. And then lastly, simply, and someone mentioned, I think it was Dr. Nyame again, you know, health care. And not just health care, but disaster relief. All of these different things are expensive. So, you know, maybe for someone who doesn't care about this specifically because they, you know, are interested in racial equality, but maybe they care about their pocketbook. It is just makes sense to invest in communities, all sorts of communities, every type of community, to make sure that this transition can happen across the board, can happen equitably, so no one's left behind. So that we, you know, can keep healthcare costs down from, you know, asthma, from natural disasters and the health concerns that, you know, that creates. There's so many reasons. I'd love to have a conversation with Michael in more depth about this, actually, because I think, you know, what this points to is that white people have a lot of learning to do. And I know, again, you know, myself included, I definitely include myself in this, that, you know, when I grew up, I was not educated about what racial inequality looks like, what it means, why it's significant, why it's important, why white people should care, how it does impact white people and hurt white people as well. So, Michael, I invite you to participate in these 22 days because I think there's a lot to learn and that we can find where we do have common ground on these issues and, you know, find ways to move forward together.
All right. We're talking about the upcoming 22 days here, April 1st to April 22nd, which is Earth Day, Climate of Change, a series focusing on awareness and action for climate justice. And Abigail McHugh Griffith, for the listeners who missed the earlier Power to the Hour, can you let them know how they can be involved?
Yes, absolutely. I invite them to visit our website, climategfl.org. Right there at the top, you'll see a little banner you can click on for all the information about the series. It will be kicking off this Thursday, so on the 1st, with Daphne's keynote. So if you've enjoyed hearing from Daphne here and want to hear more from her, she will be our opening keynote speaker. And we will have a combination of live events. Every Thursday, there will be a live event with local panelists and other keynote speakers from out of town. As well as, you know, on each day, participants will receive an email with some information about the issues, some links to more information where you can learn more, videos, articles, podcasts. Again, so we can all be learning together and developing our understanding of what climate justice is, what it means for our community, and what we can do about it. So first step is to visit our website, climategfl.org, to get yourself registered. And I will throw in one more thing, just that, you know, registration is on a sliding scale, and we invite people. We do not want costs to be a barrier to participation. So invite people to, you know, register for free. That's absolutely fine. We will also have ASL and Spanish interpreters to make the event as accessible as possible. The emails will be translated in Spanish as well. All the registration materials are translated into Spanish. Because, again, we're looking to involve a really broad section of our community to be working through these issues together and figuring out what the path forward is.
Well, in our remaining minutes, I want to talk a little about how our guests see solutions. And Daphne Rose Sanchez, who's executive director of Kinetic Communities Consulting, mentioned, you know, it's important to correct what we know has been wrong. And what do you see as sort of the first steps that are maybe within reach? I mean, this is a big, complex problem that is going to take years and a lot of collective action. But what do solutions actually look like, Daphne?
Yeah, For me, solutions look like a local democratic movement. So giving the opportunity for community members and immigrant populations to collectively fund them, give them the money, educate them on operational capacity and energy efficiency and kind of the clean energy transformation, and allowing them to have ownership of that process of what does it look like for their buildings, for their homes to transition over. How do we uplift existing local contractors to participate in that? And how are we just generating a sustainable community and a pathway forward in a way that's non-extractive, right? So not like having a big corporation come and bulldozing our diverse population. And I think that's kind of one immediate tangible pathway is when folks are thinking about projects and programming to think about who are you within that realm and who are the partners that are already existing in that ecosystem that you can work with and you can empower for them to have ownership of a project. And to be honest, it's, you know, giving up that your own personal power, right? Or giving up some of your resources to folks so that they can be a part of that solution.
Okay, Julio Jordan, how do you see solutions?
Honestly, for me, I'm a student of life. I'm a life learner. So for me, education is power. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is key. It's essential. You know, I'll be honest and I'll admit that when Abby and I spoke a while ago, she asked me a question, you know, what does environmental justice mean to you? Or what do you know about it? And for the most part, until I really sat down and analyzed it, the only thing that came to mind was Al Gore, Save the Whales, melting ice caps, polar bears that are going to be suffering, but I didn't really take the time to see how that equates or how environmental justice really pertains to me as an individual. And the things that have been spoken about in this call, redlining and how a lot of these industrial businesses have been created around areas that are impoverished, basically releasing toxic gases and all of these chemicals into the air, into the water, polluting those areas that already have, they need to be able to catch up. This is only going to push them back further. So I think education is key. And I think as we continue to educate, because we know that unfortunately, you know, the educational system wasn't really transparent when it came down to educating us in a way that really let us know how things really went. We need to be able to educate in order to empower ourselves, in order to make that change so that we are more in a position to actually make that change instead of having other individuals like environmentalists and people that are not affected within our communities. We need to be the ones that are making that change. And one quick example is the International Plaza on Clinton Avenue, right across from St. Michael's. This is a market that was just opened up, just created in partnership with Ibero to make sure that the neighborhood has access to fresh produce, to education, knowledge, events, and things that are positive, that are going to positively impact the community. Not only that, but it also created a clean space that was once littered with nothing but needles and litter, polluted. And now this has been converted into a safe space that is going to bring some of these much-needed resources to the community. So for me, the solution starts with educating yourself. I'm the first to admit that I have a lot of educating or knowledge to seek on my own. And the more that I'm able to do that, the more that I'm able to empower myself and those around me to really make that sustainable change for our communities.
Okay, about 2 minutes left in the program. Dr. Nyame, go ahead.
I agree with all the other speakers. We're all on the same page, which is wonderful. And yeah, as the equity officer for Urban League and building this new equity and advocacy division, you know, environmental justice and climate change is very much a part of what we are doing. See, we're looking to bring equity to all races, all gender, all populations in our community and the land that we stand on. You know, whether that is like the international market, but making sure that things are accessible, that there is access, whether that's, you know, continuing to work together collectively and get more to work together collectively instead of the silos that Rochester is kind of known for. This is going to be a journey. This is not an event. Because remember, Urban League was created centered around many of these same type of issues around racism. And here we are after 1965 and 2021, and only to have the veil pulled off during the two pandemics last year. It's important that we know that this is a collective effort. This just can't be what those people do over there. This has to be collective. It's going to take our government, our communities, our businesses, you know, our entrepreneurs, our people who are in poverty. It's going to take everybody in order to get to some place where people are feeling safe, feel people are being able to be healthy, their asthma goes down, because, you know, that's real big in African-American Hispanic communities, like 36 to 40% higher than the population. You know, being able to live in communities that are not in violation of federal air pollution laws, as we are now in inner cities. So it's a part of the solution. It's going to take a while, but we have to do it together.
Well, I want to thank our guests. And Abby McHugh Griffa, real quick, one more time, the website for people to learn more about what's coming up.
ClimateGFL.org.
Abby,
lots of people get themselves signed up.
Abby is the Executive Director of Climate Solutions Accelerator. Always nice having you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Nyame, yeah, Julio Jordan, Daphne Rose Sanchez, thanks to all of you. And best of luck with this. Thanks for making time for the program, everyone.
Thank you as well.
We appreciate the conversation. We appreciate the work of Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.